And I thought that I would start by doing a bit of the tail end of the stuff I had from last time on Chinese law. I then want to talk about the contents of the China to Cyberspace article, some of which was in the chapter on Chinese law and some of which wasn't, and some of which I will argue is the part of this course most relevant to the practice of modern lawyers, oddly enough, because they are solving a problem you want to know how to solve, which is how to stay out of courts, which is part of your job. And I then want to go on to talk about a few things from the my chapter on Chinese law, of which you do not have the revised version because I haven't finished the revised version yet. It'll be up real soon now if you feel like reviewing it at some point hereafter if you want to, but you don't have to. All right, so let me start by asking what the things you wanted to talk about before we start on what I wanted to talk about. Yes. Yes. I want you to build a house for me. And so it's going to cost $50,000. So I give you $50,000, and you are then supposed to build the house. And in a world where we can't enforce contracts, I never see you again. Next, imagine that I had to solve that problem and say, well, look, build the house, and when you're finished, I'll pay you $50,000. And you build the house, and when the house is finished, I mean, that's a very nice house, but I really think $50,000 is too high a price. It's sitting on my land. If you want to tear it down again, feel free, but I'll offer you $25,000. Right? In either of those cases, one party or the other has an incentive to breach the contract, because if you imagine sort of graphing over time, I have graphs, though they aren't that easy to read, in the article that you may have seen. If you graph over time the payoff to each party from breaching, ideally the contract is set up so that until the end, it's always a negative return to breach. But that isn't always the case, that if, depending on how you've structured the contract, you could easily not have a situation where at some stage, such as the first day when I've paid you and you haven't built the house yet, you're better off breaching than fulfilling if the contracts aren't enforceable. And then the question is, how do you structure a contract to keep that from happening? And sort of the simple example for the house is progress payments, but there are more difficult examples in other contexts, and since there may be unpredictable factors that change, we have a contract that you're going to sell me something at a price and then the market price goes up or down, you sometimes need more elaborate procedures for solving the problem. But the basic issue, which I'm arguing was an issue in Taiwan in 1900 and is going to be an issue in cyberspace in 2050, and is to some extent an issue for all lawyers today, is how do you structure a contract so it's never in the interest of either party to break it. That's the sort of basic theme of that chapter. And then I discuss different applications. Right. So let me go over a bit more Chinese law before we get to that. One thing that struck me about some of the cases was what looks like self-protection by the government, various ways in which the government is trying to do things to defend itself. So that, for example, the most serious crimes of all are really versions of treason. That crimes which somehow threaten the imperial rule, not only are you executed, your relatives are executed. And the ones who aren't executed are enslaved, basically. So it's a very mass kind of punishment. But there are other cases. You've got somebody who, when he is drunk, makes sort of magical claims of a sort of a vague way about he's going to get, I think, a fairy bride out of the chasm or something to marry him. And they decide it wasn't really intentional treasonous speech, so he only gets 3 years penal servitude. And that sounds like a very paranoid attitude, that anything which comes anywhere close to suggesting what, I'm not quite sure, but maybe supernatural assistance. Then you've got the fact that possessing dangerous weapons is a crime, and assault with dangerous weapons is a crime, and there's sort of an attempt to distinguish between the kind of thing you would have as an ordinary tool that could be used as a weapon and the kind of thing that's actually dangerous. Then there's another case, it's page 481 to 6, it'll fairly long one if people want to look at it, if they've got access to the book, where you've got somebody who uses a word in describing, I think, what his grandfather did, which is a word which is also used in a context that refers to something the emperor does. But perfectly normal in the context he's using it. Ah, but this is a suggestion that somehow they have some claim to be like the emperor. Yeah? How they did it, I don't know, but I think it was illegal. I think it was illegal to own some weapons, and certainly injuring somebody with a weapon becomes a more serious offense. Yeah? You're not thinking of Japan, are you? Because Japan had an attempt to basically ban firearms.
No, this was before firearms. Yeah. Probably wasn't China, I don't think.
Anyway, but there are cases, I'd have to look at the cases, but my memory is that there are cases where the fact that something happens with a weapon, there's one, I think, where he takes a weapon away from one of the attackers and then hits someone, and I think it's decided that because he didn't start with it, it's not such a serious crime, but it was a weapon rather than a tool. This is the one I was going to talk about. Not only does he use this word, which they can somehow misinterpret as a claim of something imperial, but he also is trying to inflate his grandfather's reputation. He's trying to claim that his grandfather had a library with lots of books and had written a bunch of stuff, and it looks like it's an attempt to get status, and you could see why, since it turns out it's bogus, why people would object to it, but why do you think of that as a criminal offense? And yet it is apparently a criminal offense. So, again, somehow you've got a status hierarchy and you aren't supposed to try to cheat on your position. Similarly, there are restrictions on selling books that aren't approved. There's sort of interesting couple of cases, really, which involve strikes of some sort or another. You've got workmen on an imperial project, and they cease work. And as far as you can tell, they cease work because they don't think they're being paid enough. And an official offers a compromise. And as far as you can tell, if they had accepted the compromise, it would have been all right. But they don't, and at some point somebody strikes an official, and he ends up with very severe punishment. I think he's executed, and some of the other people are punished. So again, there seems to be sort of a very definite line of you don't imply that you've got authority over the officials, as it were, showing up on that. All right. Another question, well, there's a broad question which I discussed in the chapter and I've discussed here, which is one of the things that intrigues me about systems like this, is whether you can explain it all away. That is, can you explain all of the odd features as having functional purposes, as being there for a reason? Or do you have to interpret in some cases as saying they reflect the culture, they reflect the religion, things like that? And my strategy is to try to explain everything and then see where I fail. So that one of the puzzles is all of the non-capital punishments. Why do you have execution after the assizes? And I, having reread the chapter, I now remember in more detail that what basically happens is that the best category is one which is automatically deferred. There's another one which is automatically deferred to a somewhat higher punishment. Then you get the next category up, which is the one where they draw the circle around your name, and if you last long enough through that, you get slid down to a non-capital punishment. But at least it looks, we don't really have good data, but it looks from the estimates people have made as though a sizable majority of those who are sentenced to capital punishment after the assizes don't actually get capital punishment. And then the puzzle is for that is why. And one answer is that you're trying to scare people and have them feel grateful because you've only given them 3 years of penal servitude instead of having them strangled. Another is that you're satisfying the life for a life requirement, but it seems sort of weird that you can do it with only a symbolic killing. Now, I gather, maybe somebody knows something about this. My impression is that Chinese funeral practices sometimes involved burning paper money that was not real paper money, that is not money that was actually could buy stuff with, but sort of symbolic representations of money. Anybody know anything about that?
I
or about other things. So it'll be interesting to see whether in other contexts you can sort of satisfy religious obligations. Say, well, he'll have some money in the afterlife because we printed up copies of money and burned it. I'm not sure if that's right. But you get things like that in some other religions. You get the idea of sacrificing an animal to a god. Well, do you really burn up the whole animal? That would be a terrible waste. You know, do something symbolic to say that you're killing on behalf of the god, and then you cook it and eat it. Sprinkling a few drops of wine into the ocean instead of actually dumping the sacrifice of wine and things of that sort. So maybe that really does fit the human pattern recognition or something that we can do it that way. I don't know. So another possibility is maybe it's just a change over time, because one of the other oddities, which I think I mentioned briefly, is that 50 blows of the light bamboo are actually 20 blows of the light bamboo. That you've got a conversion factor by the Manchu time. I'm not sure exactly when it comes in. And the conversion factor says each sentence of a certain number of blows is really 2/5 of that sentence. And I think that's true for all of the numbers of blows. And maybe there are reasons why punishments are getting less severe. I've seen the suggestion that they change what kind of a stick they're using, and they're now using a stick that hurts more and therefore are putting on lower things. I don't know. But again, it's sort of a weird feature of the system. Maybe the argument is that they want penal servitude because they want slaves. That is, penal servitude means you're, I guess, making iron or salt or one of the government monopolies for the government. Or maybe you're helping to build a canal. So maybe they figure what we want to do is to sentence these people to execution. That gets the greatest deterrent effect. All their neighbors hear they're going to be executed, and maybe they never see them again, but actually we're going to use them. And that, again, sort of ties in an interesting way into the 18th century English case. Because the 18th century English case, you have lots of people who were sentenced to hang by the neck until dead and then permitted to accept a pardon on condition of agreeing to be shipped off to the New World for, I think, 18 years of indentured servitude. On the other hand, I think we know in that case that the English government wasn't making money out of it. That is, that if my memory is at the beginning of the 18th century, they ran into a real problem with transportation because what they were offering the captains wasn't enough to make it worth the captains to take people. And so basically the captains took the people who they could sell at the other end for a high price, sort of, you know, a healthy young man, but older people or very young people, or maybe women, I'm not sure, just stayed in the accumulating in the prisons where they're supposed to be waiting to be transported. And my memory of the, I could look it up, but the later 18th century system is that the government was paying, though not a very large sum, to the captains rather than getting paid, and the captains get you to auction you off at the other end. That is the basic form of it is, here is this person, he can be your indentured servant for 18 years, what will you pay me for him? And that had to cover the cost of shipping them over. So that looks like a case where they're doing it and really aren't making money out of it. And we have some evidence that when the British government, for some odd reason, the colonists in the New World got uppity somewhere around 1776 and wouldn't take any indentured servants anymore. And so they accumulated and they tried to use them for work on the Thames River where they were doing some, I don't know what they were doing, dredging or building banks or something. And apparently they were doing it at a loss and eventually gave up, and then they eventually started shipping off to Australia instead. So I don't really know. I mean, the clearest case, I think, is probably galley slavery at that time, not for England, but for Mediterranean powers. And I think it's pretty good reason to think that was done at a profit, that it was useful having crews to row galleys. What I don't know about, and would be very interesting, something I don't know if I discussed it at all, but in France, at some point during the 18th century, they stopped using galleys. But they still got galley slaves. And so they set up this sort of elaborate system in one of the ports where the galley slaves are there and they're partly used as slave labor for work in the port, but they are also allowed to set up their own businesses inside the prison and then have people from outside come in and get a haircut or maybe some tailoring done, and I guess the prison gets a cut of what they do. So it's sort of a weird mixture of galley slavery and something else. And whether they did it at a profit, I don't know, because, of course, they also had to pay their guards, and they had to, you know, pay the cost of maintaining the place and feeding people and so forth. And I think it's a little...
So it seems like the real punishment is You lose your labor to a certain degree and you're ostracized.
I don't know if the Chinese case, if they're really being ostracized or not. That is, I don't know what happens when you come back, right? Suppose you have 3 years penal servitude. 3 years, most people last through longer than that. So you then, unlike the life exile, you're allowed to return to your home and family after your penal servitude. And I don't know if you're thought of as, you know, ostracized or just say, well, you know, he paid his price. Don't know. If you wanted to find out, the thing to do would be to find translations of novels. That was something I was going to suggest, by the way. For anybody who's really intrigued by this society, see if you can find fiction written in it. And the one example I know, because I read it a long, long time ago, is a book called Golden Lotus, which I should warn you is pornographic. And it's famous as both literature and pornography. Indeed, it's got a story that goes with it. The story of gold, because the problem, of course, is how do the Chinese explain why their great literature is pornographic? And the explanation is that there was a noble and virtuous official and a corrupt official. And the corrupt official somehow, I don't remember how, intrigues and destroys the noble official. And the noble official has a son who's even nobler. And the corrupt official has a son who's even more corrupt. And so the son of the noble official, who also, of course, is a literary superstar, as all noble officials in Chinese history are supposed to be, writes this novel. And the novel is a thinly disguised description of the corruption of the corrupt official. I'm not sure if it's the first or second generation corrupt official. But it's also deliberately made very lascivious. And in the corner of every page, he embeds a grain of poison. And he then sends it as a gift to the son of the corrupt official. And the son of the corrupt official is, you know, reading through it. He can't stop. And drops dead on the last page. That's the story of Golden Lotus. But you can read it. When I first discovered it, which was in the library at Harvard, all of the obscene passages were in Latin. Which I thought was sort of neat, a 19th century approach to making sure that only the proper people get to see this stuff. But I think you can get modern translations, which are all in English. But there are other things. I mean, that happened to be the one I've read. But I would suggest that if you want a feel for a society, for your own curiosity or education or anything else, if you can find things they wrote, see how they describe. Because one of the neat things about Golden Lotus is the amount of official corruption it's describing. This is clearly a society where most of the time you cannot rely on the magistrate being honest or on your if somebody kills someone and he bribes the right person, he gets away with it and so forth and so on. And that's it's not Manchu. It's earlier than Manchu, but I don't remember which dynasty it is. Yeah.
Or using that way to understand history better, have you taken into account that these stories are supposed to be interesting?
Yeah. No, that's one of the problems with the Icelandic case, that people who have looked at the Icelandic sagas have a tendency to think of it as a very violent society. And I remember my wife pointing out a long time ago a passage in, I think, Njáls saga, where there's a chapter where there's a conflict and someone is killed. And in the next chapter, there's a conflict and someone is killed. And then you notice that one of the people who participates in the second conflict as an adult had not been born at the time of the first one. So they're telescoping. They're taking out all the boring stuff. And the same thing, I think, may well be true for the Wild West, that we have a picture of the Wild West as very violent. And there is actually an article which may have become a book called The Not-So-Wild Wild West. And it's got some data. And it turns out that at least for the cities where there were these violent cow towns, murders were actually quite rare. But again, they're what you pay attention to. They're what make the stories. Similarly, I think there are a lot of people in Europe who think that America is sort of a 1930s prohibition scene with submachine guns in Chicago, because that's sort of the dramatic stuff. And I don't know what our equivalent beliefs in the other direction are. What do we believe? What the Austrians? We certainly believe that Austrians have an awful lot of good food, but that's true. So we can't quite put that in the same category. But there are probably some other things that along those lines that we believe. Frenchmen all have mistresses, I guess. Let me go on to another point which I discussed a bit, but wanted to discuss a little bit more because it's sort of interesting, which is the problem from the center's standpoint of controlling its own officials. Because they clearly pay a lot of attention to that. They've got this whole department, the censorate, which is supposed to be looking for corrupt officials. And one way of looking at it is one thing you want to do is make the officials do a good job. But the longer term thing is you don't want the system to slide down into feudalism because you know, feudalism, they have much to be said for it, but not if you're the emperor. You want to be in control of things. One thing that happens at one point, I think, which I don't discuss, but I remember seeing maybe in one of the student papers, is separation of civilian and military control so that they have a rule in which the military in a province is not under the control of the governor of the province. The general in charge of the military there is a separate person, and that makes it harder for them to work together. Essentially, they can balance each other. But another thing is they have rules. I've mentioned that you can't marry somebody in your own district if you're a magistrate. The districts get moved, the magistrates get moved around every 3 years, which in some ways is a pretty costly arrangement because it means that you're burning up a lot of expert information about the district, but you're also making it harder to establish your own power base, which you can obviously do. You can't own land in your district. Another bit that struck me, partly because of reading some stuff about the British Navy in the late 18th and early 19th century, is that in the Chinese case, the magistrates, the people around the magistrate are all low-status people. The magistrate's clerks, there are two categories of clerks, basically. There's the magistrate's private staff, which moves with him from district to district. And they, I think the magistrate has to pay himself, I believe, though, because only he has money to do it with. And then there's a second staff, which is located in the district, and which only stays for the next magistrate to arise. But I don't think any of those, I don't think, are people on their way to being magistrates. I think they're a lower status. And the reason that interested me is that if you read about the British Navy in its high period around the Napoleonic Wars, and I'm thinking mostly of fiction, but as far as I go, it's fiction written by people who knew what they were talking about. One of the things you have are essentially elaborate, I want to call them alliances, which isn't quite right, but you're a captain. And you've got a very talented, a midshipman who's really, really a bright kid, and you're going to push him, so to speak. You're going to try to make sure he makes lieutenant. And you've got a lieutenant. He's your first lieutenant. He's been your right-hand man for a year and a half, and he gets promoted to captain. And now you and that captain are, in effect, allies within the political structure of the Navy. If you have a son, you send him to be midshipman with that captain. He has a midshipman, and you've got an opening for a lieutenant, and he's a midshipman he thinks very well of, so you take him as your third lieutenant, he moves, and so forth. So it looks as though you had a fairly elaborate structure, sort of almost a spider web, of which officers were allied with which. And that could be very useful, could be functional in lots of ways, but it could also be a threat to anybody who's trying to maintain control from above. So in that sense, you can see that maybe that's part of how they were trying to do it. And, of course, the magistrate himself, anything beyond bambooing, he's got to report and get confirmed by higher-ups, which is going to restrict his control. In theory, at least, anything he does that isn't based on a statute, he's got to get appealed up to Peking. You can see tension in the system because, as some of you may have come across the case where the magistrates have been pretty clearly deliberately misreading a statute. You've got a statute which basically says that if anybody interrupts the emperor on his journeys or does a couple of other things, all of which are going appealing directly to the emperor, and it's not for a good reason, he gets punished. And the magistrates are ignoring the fact that it's supposed to be limited to interrupting the emperor and treating it as a blanket restriction on appealing decisions. And eventually someone higher up, maybe the higher ups noticed and didn't mind, but at some point somebody notices and objects and calls the magistrates on it. But you can see the sort of tension between, on the one hand, the magistrate wanting to block the lines of complaint up the hierarchy, and on the other hand, the people above wanting to keep them open enough to control the magistrates. So all of that stuff seemed to me sort of intriguing. All right, any questions on that before we go on to the China to cyberspace article? Which is probably, yes?
I thought when the punishment for having the entire state punished, that seems to kind of make sense from a practical point of view, because who else are you going to be allies if you're trying to open a member? Who else is going to benefit?
So it also means that if one person is doing it, the others may not be willing to betray him. Now, maybe they're going to have to betray him early before it gets to that point, but they're going to be, at some point, they're all locked into it as, It's very hard to tell sort of reading this stuff, because on the one hand, it's true that emperors do get overthrown. That is, you've got, it looks to me as though the typical dynasty lasts for 200 or 300 years. And then there's often an intervening period, sort of an interregnum of chaos, and to Greece, maybe of some slide back towards feudalism, and then some new person puts it back together again. But if it's happening every 300 years, they seem to be paying an awful lot of attention to it in the meanwhile to worrying about it when it's not going to happen. But don't know. It'd be nice to understand more about it. All right, let's go back then to my China to Cyberspace chapter, for any of you who actually read it. And as I was saying, maybe before some of you came in, I discovered that I had a broken link, which I have fixed now. And so you could find it if you went to my main part of my webpage, but you couldn't find it if you clicked on the syllabus, because it wouldn't work. Let me run through what that's really about. And we'll start with the one that you read about in my chapter, that you presumably did read, because that link did work. And that's the situation in Taiwan around 1900, as observed by the Japanese, when they had a commission to figure out what the law was so they could enforce it. And what you observe there is, by our standards, very little contract law. It's not quite as bad a situation as the book that I was working out of suggests, because the newer stuff makes it reasonably clear that if I really did lend you money, you didn't pay it back, and I went to the district magistrate and accused you of being a swindler, the district magistrate would probably say, all right, you got to pay the money back. But it's still the case that I don't control the case, that it's a criminal case, and that there isn't much detailed law determining what counts as breaking a contract or not breaking a contract. And yet, according to the records they found, the contractual practice was very sophisticated, that you had, you know, quite elaborate interactions across long distances. The people in Taiwan were importing and exporting across to the mainland. Taiwan is an island, as you probably know, and so forth. And then the question is, how do you do it? And it occurred to me, because I also, there's another seminar I've taught, I'm not teaching at the moment, called Legal Issues of the 21st Century. And in that one, I had thought a good deal about the problems of how you do contracts online. And the simple version of the problem, which we have already, is that in online commerce, national boundaries are invisible. You want to be able to easily do business with people all over the world. And it is not impossible to sue somebody in a foreign country if you're a big company with a staff of lawyers, but for most of us it isn't practical. So you want mechanisms for contract enforcement that are easier than that. And some of them exist. For people who pay attention to eBay, eBay has a fairly elaborate procedure for maintaining reputational information, where when you buy somebody from someone, you can report what happened. eBay has procedures for escrow transactions, where you're buying something expensive and you're buying it sight unseen. So the idea is that it goes to a trusted middleman. You can inspect it. If you don't approve it, they send it back and you don't pay your money. If you do approve it, you pay the money and they give it to you. So they're already developing some such institutions. But I was interested in part because there's a set of technologies which potentially have exactly the opposite effect of what's really been happening. That is to say, what's really been happening is a decreased level of privacy due to the fact that some of the things you can use this technology for are the sort of stuff the NSA has been doing, which is basically keeping track for the entire country of who calls whom when. That's a pen register. And their view apparently is they don't require a warrant. And they're probably right, because an ordinary pen register on one person doesn't require a warrant, unlike actually tapping the phone. It's not clear what else they've been doing. One of the points I made in Future Imperfect, which is the book that came out of the seminar I used to teach, was that the real limit on wiretapping in the past was not the need for a court order. The real limit was that it was very expensive in labor. That in order to do wiretapping, somebody's got to be sitting there listening to the phone, or at least listening to recordings of the phone, many hours a day. Right? And you can do that, but you can't do a lot of it. That was no longer the case. That problem has now been solved, because we've got speech-to-text software, and we can easily enough write computer programs that look through a body of text looking for keywords or even key phrases. So that means that it is now possible, has been possible for some time, if you can get at the phone calls, to basically, as I put it, tap every phone in the U.S. And my estimate was that the hardware to do that would cost a few billion dollars. So fairly small change by government standards nowadays. And you don't actually have a human listen to all of that. You have a computer listen to all of that, and the computer then forwards to the humans the small percentage of calls that they think are important, the ones that match whatever their criteria are, where people are speaking Arabic, or where they're talking about bombs, or whatever they think. We're talking about drugs, depending on what they're doing it. The DEA is involved in this stuff, too. Yo?
Wouldn't any criminal, decent sophistication know to, use code words so as not to give up
You might consider the question of why the Director of National Intelligence lied under oath to Congress.
Why?
Yeah, he did.
Right, but why didn't he?
Because he did not want it to be publicly known that the government was following all of the phone calls.
So as long as the criminals don't think that the government's following all the phone calls.
And as long as they don't know, then they may not be careful enough. That's, I think, the theory. That's right. So that something which actually might raise interesting legal issues, I'm not sure, apparently the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, instructed its people to deliberately mislead courts about the source of their information. Whether this involved perjury, I don't know. It may just have been what you don't say. I guess technically you're swearing to tell the truth and the whole truth. But my guess is you're unlikely to be convicted of perjury if you don't say the way we got onto this guy was. You only say we had reason to be suspicious of him, and then get a correct account of how you accounted the evidence thereafter. So as far as I can tell, the DEA was doing its best to keep secret the fact that the phone company was giving them a full record of who called whom when. And the NSA has been trying to keep as secret as it can what it's been doing. So, my basic prejudice is I shouldn't do any of this stuff. But, of course, it's easier for me because I don't think the drug laws should be enforced anyway. So it's not, be a harder problem than I thought they should be enforced. As I may have told you, at one point I got an invitation to speak at a conference on money laundering, and I said to the guy who invited me, "You do realize that I'm in favor of money laundering, don't you?" And he said, "Yes." That was sort of fun, but in any case, I'm not sure whether if you believe that all these laws should be enforced, whether this is an effective way or not. But it might be. I mean, it's taking advantage of technology. But what struck me a long time ago was the potential in exactly the opposite direction. How many people here know what public key encryption is? And yet, if I asked you if you knew what an atomic bomb was, you'd all know. I want to get a message to you that he can't read. And the traditional solution to this problem is I encrypt it, which means I scramble the message with what's called a key, which is instructions for scrambling and unscrambling. And you have the key, and so you unscramble it. And the trouble with that method is that if I don't have a trusted way, a safe way of getting you the message, if I could safely get the message, I wouldn't have to worry about his reading it. If I don't have a safe way of getting you the message, I may not have a safe way of getting you the key either. And if he has intercepted if the person who brought you the key is also working for him, now he can read all my messages, but I think he can't. And the solution to this was a mathematical process that people came up with, I suppose by now, about 40 years ago, called public key encryption. And it depends on mathematics that generates a pair of keys, two long numbers, such that if you use one of them to scramble the message, you need the other one to unscramble it. Either way. So if you scramble with key A, key A won't unscramble, but key B will. And if you scramble with key B won't unscramble, but key A will. So the basic logic of how you use this technology is you roll up a pair of keys. One of them you call your public key, and you tell everybody what that is. I tell her, I make sure his spy hears it, I put it in the phone book, I want to make sure everybody knows that public key. My private key never leaves my hot little hands. You want to send me a secret message, you encrypt it with my public key, you send it to me, I decrypt it with my private key. He has my public key, he can send me secret messages too. But he can't read your secret messages, and therefore it is a way of getting privacy and communication which does not depend on having a reliable channel. It depends on a reliable channel, reliable enough so that I can make sure you know my public key. But it doesn't have to be reliable enough so I can make sure nobody else knows it. All right, so yes.
So the other person has to protect what he says.
You have to do it the other way. You have my public key, I have your public key.
Okay.
Ideally, everyone in the world has my public key, and I have everyone in the world's public key. That would be a perfectly, a fully functional public key infrastructure. All right? So one of the potential vulnerabilities is key distribution. If you wanted to attack that system, one of the things you might try to do is to give me a key that I think is your public key, but it's really a public key that he's got the private key to. And so I send you a message, he intercepts it, he decrypts it because he's really got the private key for it. He reads it, he re-encrypts it with your real public key and sends it on to you, and you think it's perfectly safe and I think it's perfectly safe and he's read our messages. That's what's called a man-in-the-middle attack. But as long as we've got a way of, but then there are ways of doing it. So that, for example, suppose that there are some public organizations, say the American Express Company, which people trust and which are very well known. So the American Express Company has its public key, private key pair, and its public key is in the window of every American Express office in the world. So anybody can copy it down. And what does it do with it? Well, I go to American Express and I say, I want to be able to tell people what my public key is. So I want you to write out a document which says the public key of David D. Friedman, who is employed at Santa Clara University and has passport number such and such. Here, I'll show you my passport and I'll show you my ID from the university, is such and such. You will then sign that message. I haven't explained signing. Signing is the reverse, but it's the same logic. I want to prove a message was from me. I encrypt it with my private key, send it to him with a note in clear saying who it's from. He decrypts it with my public key. The fact that it could be decrypted with my public key means it was encrypted with the matching private key, which only I have. So that's how I prove a message comes from me. American Express, similarly, signs my document with their private key. Everyone in the world has their public key. So anyone in the world can check the document and say, yes, indeed, David D. Friedman's public key is such and such. American Express vouches for it. Consequently, we know how to send him secret messages. All right, so far? You're looking puzzled.
Well, it just seems like through algebra or something, you'd be able to figure out, as long as you know what the message is supposed to mean and what the public key is,
what you could do is to encrypt every possible message with the public key until you get a match. But you will want a good supply of candles because the sun will burn out before you're finished. Now, all of this depends on things like how long a key you use. So that what you're describing is what's referred to as a brute force attack. And a brute force attack basically consists of trying everything until something works. And you can do it in either of two directions. One way is to try every possible private key. Suppose the private key is 80 digits long, try every 80-digit number. Try doing the arithmetic and figure out how many 80-digit numbers there are. All right. The other approach is take every possible message, encrypt it with the public key, and check to find one that matches. So neither of those is going to be practical if I use a reasonably long key. Now, one of the implications of this is that as computers get faster, you lengthen your keys. But the general rule seems to be that time to encrypt increases more slowly with length of key than time to break. So if all the computers are twice as fast, I can double the time it takes you to crack my code while less than doubling the time it takes me to encrypt it. We both have twice as fast computers, so I'm now doing it faster than before, and you're having as hard a time as before. That's the basic logic of it. There are a couple of other possible holes. That's the obvious hole is that I'm careless. The obvious hole is that I write my private key down somewhere and you see it. Or my private key is in my computer because I'm not really going to do all this math myself, and you've got some way of accessing the computer. So all of this is vulnerable to human error, as it were. Then there's the other possibility, which is that perhaps somebody figures out some new mathematics that the mathematicians don't know that lets you invert public key. It lets you deduce the private key from the public key. And the standard system that's currently being used is one which depends on the difficulty of factoring. That imagine that you create a large prime number by multiplying together a bunch of large primes and adding one. If you work it, you can work it out, you can prove that that's prime pretty easily. Now, so it's easy to go in that direction. It's a one-way process. Suppose you have a very large prime number and you want to figure out what its factors were. That's a much, much harder problem. All right? You have to try everything again. All primes, at least. So one of the issues is whether or not someone makes a mathematical breakthrough which suddenly gives an easy way of solving what has been a mathematically hard problem. And people have speculated that maybe the NSA has done it, but there's no evidence they've done it. The sort of a famous story in this field, have you ever heard of Fermat's theorem, Fermat's last theorem? Fermat was a French mathematician, and Fermat has a note in one of his notebooks describing a very simple mathematical theorem. It's number theory, and you could, you know, write it down in a minute. And his note says, I have found a very elegant proof of this theorem, but it's too long to write down here. This was like 200 or 300 years ago. A few years ago, somebody finally thought he had proved Fermat's theorem. And he did it in a way Fermat couldn't possibly have done, because the proof basically consisted... No, I'm confusing it with a different problem. Anyway, let me leave that, because I don't remember the details enough. But it was clearly a very high-power, difficult thing. And we do not know whether Fermat actually discovered an elegant proof that nobody since then has managed to reproduce, or whether he just made a mistake. But we do know that there is a record of somebody sending Fermat a large prime, a large number, and saying, I'm not sure, is this a prime? And Fermat writing back, no, it is not a prime, its prime factors are. And apparently there is no known way he could have done that. So that raises the possibility that Fermat might have gotten farther in number theory than anybody has since, and just unfortunately not written it all down. But it's only a possibility. It's also possible that he had come across that number before, that he had tried multiplying a couple of large primes and see what it got or whatever. So it makes a good story. But my point is only that I don't want to overstate the case, but in terms of the math as we now know it, it looks as though you can do public key encryption in such a way that the NSA, in fact, can't read it. As a practical matter, can't in a plausible length of time, even with all the computing power they have. But the more power they have, the longer the key you need to have in order to make it hard to crack. Yeah?
I don't understand the explanation.
Yes. Man in the particular example, there are different man-in-the-middle attacks, but let's suppose that you... In order for me to send you a secret message, I need your public key. How did I get your public key? You sent me a message in clear, which told me what your public key was. All right, let's suppose. But in a matter of fact, he was able to intercept messages between you and me. So when you sent that message with some way of verifying which wasn't encryption, so, you know, you had some text which had some secret you knew to show it was really from you, he just replaced your public key with the public key that he has the private key to. He rolled up a pair. I now think that public key is yours, but it's really his. I send you a message encrypted with that public key. He decrypts it with a matching private key. He encrypts it with your public key, which he got when he intercepted the message. He sends it to you. It looks to both of us as though we're having a secret conversation, but we aren't really. So that would be one example. There are other man-in-the-middle attacks, but the general idea of a man-in-the-middle attack is somebody who's in a position to intercept messages as they go through. And you can, there are various tricks you can do if you can do that. Anyway, so part of what public key encryption potentially gives you is a world where you can communicate with any stranger with a high degree of confidence that no third party is reading the message. All right? That's something we don't have at the moment. We could have. A second thing it gives you is the ability to communicate with a stranger in a way that proves your own identity. So if you imagine, you think about commerce online in a world where real space is becoming less and less important, which is the world we live in, I have a reputation as an expert in something. Once that reputation is known, somebody else might want to pretend to be me, to free ride on that reputation. So I want a way of proving I'm me. Digital signatures give me that. Alternatively, let us suppose that I am organizing a criminal conspiracy. I want to overthrow the government or smuggle drugs or you know, argue for banned views in Saudi Arabia or something, or in the U.S. for that matter. I want to make sure that the person who I'm communicating with planning our terrorist act or act of rebellion or demonstration is really who he says he is and not an FBI agent pretending to be who he says he is. So once I've somehow gotten the public key to identify that person from some other trusted person, maybe I can now communicate with him and make sure the messages are really from him. Let me give you my favorite criminal example. This is what I like to describe as my business plan for Murder Incorporated. If you think about assassination, as far as one can tell from press reports, the price of a hitman is probably a bit less than the price of a new car. Most of us can afford a new car if it's really important to us. If it's not right now, you will be able to pretty soon. Most of us, in practice, even if we really hate somebody, it is not practical to arrange to have him killed. And the reason is not that we can't afford the price, although it might be pretty expensive. The reason is we don't have the contacts. We don't have a way of knowing who is reliably selling that service, and again, making sure he's not really an FBI agent pretending to be a hitman. This problem we can solve. And so the business plan goes as follows. The first step is that on billboards all over the country, a long number appears. And the message is just write down this number. And it's enough places so many people write it down. The next thing that happens is that in the New York Times, there is a classified ad, which is gibberish. The next thing that happens is a very high-profile assassination. And I figure that probably politicians aren't important enough, so I thought maybe a bomb at the Academy Awards would do it. What happens immediately after that is an anonymous message to all of the news media, which say, if you use that number on the bulletin board as the key to decrypt the gibberish ad in the New York Times, you will discover a description of the assassination published 2 days before it happened. We have just demonstrated that that number is a public key belonging to an organization that is willing to kill people and can do it. We now go into business. We have to fill out some more details. We've got to have some way of telling people how to get a message to us. But the basic logic of it is that if I want to hire an assassin, I get a message to Murder Incorporated, encrypted with their public key, which the FBI can't read. That message includes my public key if they don't already have it. I tell them who I want murdered. I haven't gotten to anonymous cash yet, but take my word for it that in this future we'll have ways of making payments that aren't traceable. And now I can hire a hitman. So that's the downside of what I'm describing, what I like to call a world of strong privacy. And the upside is a world where people really can't control other people because you can't control stuff you can't see. So that's a potential future, and it's interesting in lots and lots of different ways, which I'm not going to go into now. And if you're curious enough, I have an article up on my webpage, an old article called A World of Strong Privacy, which describes it. But one of the implications, if we just go back to away from hitmen and such to ordinary business dealings, is that there will be people who are selling services online who wish to be anonymous. And who can be anonymous, that there's a sense in which part of the elegance of public key encryption is that it lets you combine anonymity with reputation. Right? That sounds impossible. But the story I tell for this one is a much more minor crime. I'm assuming that I want to practice law in the state of California. And this is illegal because I have never passed the bar. I'm not licensed to practice in the state of California. I'm also not competent to, but suppose I were. So what I'm going to do is to sell legal advice as Legal Eagle Online. And I set up a website, and I do various things to make it hard to trace who the website really is. And the website has got my public key on it. And for a while, I give free advice. People send me messages, what do I do in this situation? I give them advice. And after 6 months or a year, people check with their lawyer. Yep, good advice. He knows what he's doing. Now I start selling legal advice. And part of the beauty of this is I've got to stay anonymous so the Bar Association can't get me. But I also have to have a reputation. People know they can trust me, but that's all right because my public key identifies me without telling anybody whether I'm a man, a woman, how old, what state I live in, what continent I'm on, or any of that sort of irrelevant detail. So it really is a potentially interesting and very powerful technology. One of the other things you can do with related technologies is what's called anonymous digital cash. That is, there are procedures known, though not implemented, there's no bank doing it, which let me make a payment to you by sending you a message in a way in which you don't have to know who I am, I don't have to know who you are, and the bank that's only holding the money never knows who either of us is. And if people are curious enough, I can point you where I've got a description of a sort of a low-tech way of doing this as opposed to the high-tech way, which is how you would actually do it. Now, at this point, something has come into existence since I wrote the book and wrote about this stuff is Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is a non-government currency. As in its default arrangement, as originally set up, it is the least anonymous currency that has ever existed. I think that's a fair statement. Because the way Bitcoin works is that every transaction between any two people is known to everybody who uses Bitcoins, which sounds enormous waste of information, but computers do this stuff really cheap. However, I gather there are procedures people have set up in which essentially every time you make a transaction, the money then gets sort of remixed with money other people have used in such a way that you can't tell which dollar going in is which dollar going out, and you can thus effectively anonymize it. And whether that's right, I don't know. But Bitcoin is interesting because unlike all the stuff I'm talking about, it's actually out there. I even have, I don't know, $50 or $100 in Bitcoin. Maybe it's more or less. I don't know if it's gone up or down since then, but I did actually get through, I think, the world's only Bitcoin ATM, which was at a conference I was speaking at in New Hampshire sometime in the last year or so, and that was sort of fun. But in any case, Bitcoin is there, it's usable, and it's a weird, that would be a long talk, but I'm just going to talk it out. I'm not really expert on it, but it's a privately created monetary system, not denominated in dollars, done entirely online. So anyway,
So it definitely is apparent that you can, encrypt code and then have your private key or whatever.
Yep.
But as far as the keyword searches, let's say the NSA do, how do they know that they're even talking in code in the first place? How do they know that they're just not talking about something that isn't important to the NSA at all?
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand you. If I'm doing encrypted stuff, NSA is never going to read it.
So
what NSA is doing at the moment, presumably, is that they get permission from the FISA court to tap your phone, and they do so on the grounds that you are one of 300 people who at some point had a phone call with somebody who at various points in the past had phone calls with two people who didn't get terrorists. I think that's roughly, obviously I'm making up the numbers, but I think roughly speaking that what's going on now is that they are tracking everybody's phone calls, tapping a small fraction of them, and they're tapping them when the tracking pattern or other information makes them think there is some noticeable chance there's something there. At that point, I think they're getting warrants from the FISA court. I have my suspicion of whether it's all constitutional, because the Fourth Amendment, the warrant is supposed to specifically describe, et cetera. And I don't see how the FISA court could be actually giving specific warrants for as many people as NSA seems to be tapping. So my guess is that each warrant is really letting them tap 1,000 phones or something. But I don't know. That's a suspicion. And I think that may be unconstitutional, but it's never come to the Supreme Court. It hasn't gotten to it yet, because the argument the government has been using is that nobody can sue unless they can prove that their communication was intercepted. But since the government is keeping a secret whose communication they're intercepting, that gives you a problem in getting standing. And at this point, I think the government has now agreed to say that they are, I forget who it is, but there's somebody who I think they have announced that they've intercepted or something, and therefore setting it up so they can be in court. And of course, my guess is that at this point they couldn't have kept it out of the courts forever, because I think at this point enough has been conceded so that you can say with considerable confidence that although your phone may not have been tapped, there has been a pen register on you. Because I think everybody has. I think that's what the evidence seems to suggest now, as far as I can tell. I was wondering, by the way, since the president claims that he didn't know that they were wiretapping the head of Germany, at what point he's going to say thank you to Edward Snowden for telling him useful information that he didn't know. The other thing, by the way, this is entirely a digression, but except it was on my blog, that I was really struck by the behavior of our senator, Dianne Feinstein, that her view is that if the NSA is doing a pen register on everybody in the U.S., that's not a big problem, you see. If they are tapping, a few thousand or a few hundred thousand, well, that's not a big problem. But they're tapping the phone with important people like her? We need to send an investigation immediately. And it did seem, maybe I'm wrong, but what I get out of that really is sort of people who believe that they believe in equality, but in fact believe that they're an upper caste and sort of matter in a way in which the rest of us don't. But that may be unfair. I don't know, Dianne. I'm just judging by how rapidly she switched from being an unqualified defender of anything the NSA was doing to suddenly being upset when the stuff about Angela Merkel came out. struck me as odd and interesting. Anyway, so let me go back to how all this stuff works. So the point I'm now making is that we're now in a world where we aren't now. We can be. We know how to create a world, whether or not we do it, in which people have a very high level of privacy, and in which you might be dealing with many people, including contractual dealings, but you don't know who they are. And that then gets you into a situation, this is where we wired from China to cyberspace, that just as in Taiwan, you had to be able to enforce your contracts almost entirely through private means. So I'm arguing we're beginning to get into a world and could get very far into a world where contracts online have to be enforced by private mechanisms rather than by courts. That's why there's something similar. And then I want to say that as a matter of fact, this is relevant to you too, because although it's true you can go to court, you don't want to. That part of your job as a lawyer, if you're a contract lawyer, part of your job is to arrange a contract that neither party will ever want to break. Because, you know, courts are uncertain, they're expensive. So therefore, really, the issues that these people are facing, the issues the Chinese were facing 100 and some years ago, are issues that that if you do contracts, you're going to be facing. Which is, how do we arrange a contract to make it as unlikely as possible that somebody will try to break it? That's why I claim this is the only part of this course that's actually of real world relevance to you. The rest is all just fun. I hope it's fun. I think it's fun. And there are a number of ways you can do it. One of them is one of the methods that eBay uses. I want to buy something. I don't know if I can trust you. But there's somebody else I can trust, somebody in real space with a visible identity I can trust. So the deal, and who you can trust. So the deal is you send the goods to him with the price. I inspect the goods. If the goods are what you claim, I send you the money, you send him instructions to release the goods, and I get the goods. So that's one way of what I think of as leveraging a third party's reputation. It depends on him being trusted, and of course none of you want to trust him. I don't want to take this as real world advice or anything. But this depends on somebody who you can trust. Let me go back though, because the first method is, as far as possible, set things up so that the result of a court suit, if you had one, would be to leave the situation as it is if you don't have one, because that's where you are when you start. So that suggests that where possible, you want the rule to be letting costs lie where they fall. If you imagine caveat emptor is sort of the standard example in our system. If we say that the legal rule is that if I buy something and there's something wrong with it, I can sue you, I need a court to sue you in. If the legal rule is if I buy something, once I've bought it, I get to inspect it in advance, I get to be able to, once the contract is through, it's over. I got no more claim against you. If I was fool enough to buy something defective, tough luck. That may be a bad rule in some ways, but it's got the virtue that it's self-enforcing. Because you've got my money, I got the goods. So that's sort of one, and I think it's pretty clear that if you look at the Chinese rules, not that there are no exceptions, but there's a strong bias in that direction. So that basically ownership was always supposed to go with possession. You didn't have the situation where I had bought the goods, but they were still in your hands. You might, I guess, have it in the case where I had bought the goods and they were in the hands of a delivery agent who I had appointed. I think that's as far as you normally go. So that's one approach to doing it. Another approach is what I was discussing a little bit earlier, which is that you time performance in ways designed to avoid the situation where at some instant I can gain by breaking it. So that if we go back to building the house, we neither pay in advance nor pay at the end. We pay progress payments along as it goes, so that if at any point I pull out, either of us pulls out, we're both worse off. That's the objective we want. If I pull out, I have a half-built house, which I've half paid for, which will be hard to get somebody else to complete because you know how you're doing it. If you pull out, you've half built the house and you've been half paid for it, and on the whole, you're expecting a completion payment or something, which will make it worth doing. So that's part of it. And the problem with that is the uncertainty. The problem with that is what happens if we have a contract where there is no way of structuring the payments that meets that requirement, because halfway through, the price of the input might double, the value to me of what you're producing might go up or down. You can think of lots of ways in which things could change, so that even though we structured a contract so that as we intended it to go, it would never be in either of our interests to back out. What actually happens suddenly makes it in my interest to back out or in your interest to back out. All right? I get a better offer for the land that I've agreed to sell you, something of that sort. And so one interesting solution to that is the first step, go back a step. First step we've already seen, and that is timing the payments. And so you can think of that as a deposit, for example. If we have a situation where it looks as though at the very beginning of the contract it might pay me to default, then I give you a deposit, and then that deposit forfeits by default. But the problem is that anything I do of that sort, while it lowers my incentive to default, it raises yours. Because you've got the deposit at the beginning, and if you back out, you keep the money. So therefore, we've got the problem that if you sort of think of it as a graph of our benefit from defaulting over time, a deposit shifts one graph down and one graph up, and it may mean that I no longer have a peak above the line where it works to default, but now you do. And one interesting solution to that is to replace the deposit with a hostage. And what's the difference between a deposit and a hostage? A hostage is a deposit which it hurts me to lose but doesn't help you to get. So if you think of the traditional example, I leave my son with you. It's a terrible thing for me if you kill my son, but it doesn't get you anything. Therefore, I now have an incentive to complete it. And again, it's risky. Have I told you the William Marshall story? It's a good story. I'll tell it to you. This is real history, we think. When King Henry I dies, he has a daughter and no son. And he has tried to swear everybody in sight to support his daughter. I'm not sure if he intends her actually to be ruling queen or just to pass the rule through to her son when she has a son. I think she has an infant son by this time. And unfortunately, she's out of England when he dies. And his nephew, Stephen of Blois, gets to London first. And conveniently enough, Stephen's younger brother is the Archbishop of Canterbury and crowns him king. And there is then about a 14-year, rather unpleasant civil war between the followers of Stephen and the followers of Matilda. It finally ends with a compromise in which it is agreed that Stephen will be king for the rest of his life, but Matilda's son will then be king and becomes Henry II, one of the more successful English kings. In the course of this event, of the Civil War, there is a man, a nobleman by the name of Gilbert Marshall, sort of middle-level nobleman. And Gilbert Marshall is a pretty honest man by the standards of that Civil War, because he only changes sides once. He starts out fighting for Stephen, Matilda offers him better terms, and he spends the rest of the war fighting for Matilda. And at one point in the war, Gilbert is holding a castle for Matilda, and Stephen shows up in front of it with an army and is about to siege the castle and take it. And Gilbert says to Stephen, look, friend, I got a deal for you. Sieging this castle can get people killed, it's going to take you time, it's going to be a real pain. So here's the deal I'm offering you. Give me 3 days. I will send a message to Matilda asking her to bring an army to relieve the siege. If she does, you can go fight her, no problem with mine. If she doesn't, I'll surrender the castle, you don't have to siege it. Deal. And Stephen, this is a great deal. How do I know you'll keep it? He says, I'll give you my young son, William. So he hands over William, and Stephen goes off because he's got other things to do with his army. And Gilbert, who has no intention of surrendering the castle, hires troops and buys supplies and gets ready for a siege, because he, like Stephen, knows that Matilda has no army within 3 days available to come lift the siege. 3 days later, Stephen comes back, says, all right, time up, surrender. Gilbert says, ha ha, fooled you. Stephen says, I'll kill the kid. And Gilbert says, have I not? Three more. And besides, the hammer and the anvil to forge some more. And Stephen, who probably was too soft-hearted for the job he had taken on, never actually kills William. The story is at one point he's going to shoot the boy out of the siege engine over the wall, and William, seeing the siege engine, thinks it's a piece of playground equipment and starts climbing it. And in general, apparently, it was sufficiently charming so that Stephen backs down, never gets, I don't know how he eventually gets back to his father, he does eventually. William goes on to become the most famous tournament knight of Western Europe. and regent of England after King John dies. Very interesting example if you sort of social mobility in the feudal system, because his son is his father is a minor noble. He ends up as one of the most important nobles in England. And probably, as I see it, William Marshall, with regard to medieval combat, probably regarded Richard the Lionhearted as a talented amateur. Yes, you had a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, this is a bit of a tangent, but the comparability in other agents, I mean, supposedly we have high mobility, but I'm wondering if in the time of ours, is it really that different from other times? Like, that is, you can become really rich, but you have to be very lucky and talented.
Either will do. If you're lucky enough, you can win the lottery, which requires no talent. And if you're talented enough, I don't think you have to be lucky. Are you?
Assuming that you get noticed.
Bad luck would subvert it. I don't think you need extraordinary luck if you're really good at doing something, is my impression. But, yeah, no, I think probably we have more mobility than some past societies, but certainly past societies did have mobility. There's one of my students the previous year in this class was talking about one of the Chinese emperors who starts out as the son of a peasant and basically makes it all the way to the top through his own ability. He thought it was sort of the most dramatic such story in history. He's right or not. I don't even remember which. I think it may have been the first Song emperor. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, I think his parents starved to death, if I remember correctly, and sort of things are really chaotic. He's off by himself. But there certainly was social mobility. That's how much is hard to be sure. But it's clear that you have people who start below the noble class who are basically servants of the king and become important in that way. And in the case of William, he starts out as sort of pretty minor nobility. He is a very successful tournament knight. He is also, since those are the same skills being used in warfare, he's also a very useful part of King Henry's team, so to speak. And he more or less saves Henry from being captured near a little bit before Henry's death by stopping a force led by Henry's son, Richard, who's at war with his father at this point, in order to long enough for the king to get away. And Henry, before he dies, gives William the wardship of Isabel of Pembroke. Isabel of Pembroke is the daughter of the Earl of Pembroke, who has no sons, and therefore the heiress. And the Earl of, and her mother is the daughter of Dermot of Leinster, the King of Leinster, who allied with Strongbow against the people of Leinster, who had kicked him out of Leinster, with the result that William Marshall ends up, through his wife, as both Earl of Pembroke and de facto ruler of a quarter of Ireland. So that's sort of an interesting story. But anyway, that would be a long story. William Marshall is a character I find quite interesting for lots of reasons. Anyway, going back to the question, though, of enforcing contracts. So what I've really been saying is that you have these problems with how you set up contracts, and if you read the article, which the link now works, you can see a lengthier discussion of how you do it in order that it will not pay people to break it. The final mechanism, I should say that you might argue that in the Chinese case, the threat of accusing people to the court is itself a hostage. That is to say, it's a way in which I can impose a cost on you that doesn't get me anything, so it doesn't pay me to do it as a way of breaking it. But it's a way in which I can punish you for breaking the contract, and it's going to work better if you really have broken the contract, because then maybe I can persuade the magistrate to punish you for doing so. And similarly, I suggest in the article, in modern criminal markets, your life is a hostage. You're a professional drug dealer. You sell me a bag of what's supposed to be cocaine and is actually talcum powder. What do I do? First, I go to somebody prominent and convince him that you've really cheated me, because I don't want the reputation of just killing people who deal with me, right? That would make it hard for me to do the next deal. But I want the reputation of killing people who cheat me, and then I have them killed. I hire a hitman. It costs less than a new car, right? And I have the contacts, right? I'm in that market, by assumption. So in a sense, your life is serving as a hostage, and mine, of course. But either of us can at some cost get the other one killed, doesn't get anything out of that. But the ability to do that is a reason to keep your contract. The final method, which I discussed a little before, is reputation. And as I discussed before, the essential requirement for reputational enforcement to work is that interested third parties are able to, at reasonably low cost, to figure out who really cheated. And my mechanism in the Chinese case, you've got the equivalent of a digital signature, which is called a chop. It was a stamp that was used to stamp documents to prove that I'd really signed them. It was hard to make copies of it. In the cyberspace case, the mechanism, as I imagine it, goes as follows. You have arbitrators out there who have the reputation of being honest, competent people. You and I agree to a contract. In agreeing to the contract, we agree that she will be our arbitrator, because both of us trust her. And the contract includes her public key, which allows other people to check that a message is really from her. And it is digitally signed by both of us. So it's encrypted, in effect, by both my private key and your private key, separately. So we have two copies, say. Now, I, being a wicked, evil person, break the contract. You ask her to arbitrate. She says, I owe you $1,000. I refuse to pay. She writes up a statement saying, these events happened. I was the arbitrator. The person who broke the contract refused to pay. Digitally signs it with her, using her private key, and gives it to you. You now have two documents. You have a contract which I signed, agreeing that she's the arbitrator, which proves that I agreed to her as the arbitrator, and you have her document, which proves that according to her, I cheated. You put those documents up on a web page with my name all over it. Anybody who wants information about me finds that web page, and at very least, he doesn't have to take any of the facts. All he has to do is check the digital signatures, and he now knows that the arbitrator I agreed to says I cheated. Doesn't prove that I cheated. Maybe I made a mistake and she's really, you know, sold out to you or something. But at least I thought I could trust her, and that's fairly good evidence. So that sort of is an example of how you would do it in that world in order to use reputational enforcement. And then if you have a situation where one of us has a reputation and the other one doesn't, in that case, what you do is you structure the contract to put all of the risk of breach on the person who has the reputation. And in fact, this is my theory of what's going on in the present world. I may be wrong. But there are quite a lot of contexts where you click on a contract online, usually without reading it. And if you read it, it looks like a very one-sided contract. It looks like a contract giving the seller all the advantages. And what I think is going on is that the seller is Apple Computer or Blizzard, which runs World of Warcraft. They have strong reputational incentives not to be believed to cheat their customers. I, on the other hand, don't have any reputational incentives. Nobody, if I cheat Apple, Blizzard will never find out, or vice versa. So therefore, they're setting it up so that all the legal advantages with them, but all the reputational advantages with me, and therefore I expect them not to actually take advantage of the situation. And that is, if I'm right, that it's a result of a legal system where if they don't have all the legal advantage, they're afraid that they might lose the case or have to spend a lot of money if I do something they disapprove of, and where most of the time I can trust them not to take advantage of what I've agreed to. Anyway, and finally, if neither of us has a reputation, we're back with the escrow method. But we have some. It could be an arbitrator. If we really trust you, each of us deposits $1,000 in digital cash with you before we sign the contract. And if you conclude one of us broke the contract, the money forfeits to the other one. All right, that's clearly a possible way of doing it. So all of those represent ways in which you can solve this problem. I think we're about out of time now, so read the article if you want. I think it's a fun article, but I can't compel you to do anything at all. The world being as it is, and all of us being free.